Welcome back to In Summation, The Final Word, a podcast for inquisitive minds on real-life courtroom drama. I'm your host, Paul Townsend. Today, we're going to be talking about a household name that has become synonymous with sociopathic criminal insanity. There are some very interesting legal issues with this trial, including how an individual can be charged for a crime that they were not physically present for the commission of, as well as what happens when a client demands to testify against the wishes of their attorney. This episode's case goes back in time to the late 1960s and early 1970s. Civil rights movement had started, and race relations were on everyone's mind. While most people were thinking about how to remove racism and facilitate harmony between all Americans, there were a few people who believed that full racial integration was simply not possible, and that America was destined for a race war. One such man was obsessed with the idea of a race war. He turned his home at the Spahn Ranch in Los Angeles into a cult gathering place where he preached sermons of an upcoming race war, where he, a white man, would lead the African-American people to destroy white society in America, and then he and his family would assume leadership of this new country. To spark this race war, which he called Helter Skelter, after his interpretation of a popular Beatles song, his followers went to the home of actress Sharon Tate and stabbed Tate, coffee heiress Abigail Folger, Wojtek Frykowski, Jay Sebring, and also shot an unfortunate stranger named Stephen Parent. The following night, Lino LaBianca and his wife Rosemary LaBianca were also murdered in a particularly gruesome fashion. This is the state of California versus Charles Manson. Charles Millis Manson was born November 2, 1934, in Cincinnati, Ohio. His mother was 16-year-old Kathleen Maddox, an alcoholic who went to jail when Manson was 5 years old for assault and robbery. Manson's father was Colonel Walker Henderson Scott Sr. He never took responsibility for being Manson's father and only grudgingly agreed to a judgment confirming as much when a paternity test showed that he was, in fact, Manson's father. He was a con man who had tricked Manson's mother into believing he was in the army, when in fact his first name was actually just Colonel. When he discovered she was pregnant, he told her he was being deployed overseas on army business. After several months, she realized that he was never coming back. Shortly before Charles Manson was born, his mother married William Manson in the late summer of 1934. They divorced in 1937 when William could no longer handle Kathleen's gross neglect of Charles, but Manson retained the last name. When his mother went to prison, Manson lived with an aunt and uncle in West Virginia. He reunited with his mother when she was paroled in 1942. She was a largely absent mother, spending her nights drinking, while Manson himself skipped school and caused trouble in the community. When Manson was 9, he set his school on fire. He was later sent to a strict school for delinquent boys run by Catholic priests called Gibralt. Even minor infractions received beatings. Manson ran away several times as a young teenager, began a cycle of escalating crime and reformatories while he was still a minor. He stole a car, obtained guns, robbed people in stores. He was arrested, sent back to reform school, ran away, committed another crime, was rearrested, and the process began again, and again, and again. We don't really have time to go through Manson's extensive criminal history, but suffice it to say that he has never been a model citizen. Prior to the incidents, which were the subject of his case, he had spent roughly half of his life in correctional institutions. We will quickly summarize his checkered past. In 1948, he committed his first real crime, at the age of 14. It was the burglary of a grocery store. He's sent to a juvenile detention center. He escaped, committed two armed robberies. He's caught again, sent to a reform school in Indiana, where he remains for about 3 years, with the exception of his 18 escape attempts. In one of those attempts, in 1951, Manson was able to steal a car and robbed 15 to 20 gas stations along the route he was taking to escape. He He was caught and sent back to reform school. A few weeks before he was scheduled to be released, he was caught sodomizing another boy while holding a razor blade to his neck. He continued throughout the 1950s and 60s, committing crimes. He married twice, fathered a child with each wife, and then divorced twice. Interestingly, when Manson was not pursuing his criminal endeavors, he was also a musician on the fringe scene of the Los Angeles entertainment world. As a singer-songwriter, he found himself in a brief encounter with a man named Terry Melker, a record producer. He met Melker through Dennis Wilson, one of the Beach Boys. The Beach Boys had actually recorded a song written by Manson titled Never Learn Not to Love, but they didn't give Manson credits on the album. Dennis Wilson was asked about this later and told an interviewer that Manson didn't want writing credits. He just wanted money. So Wilson gave him about $100,000 worth of material goods for the rights to his song. There is one studio album which Manson produced and wrote. It's called Lie, The Love and Terror Cult. Carl and Brian Wilson, also of the Beach Boys, co-produced about 10 songs, most of which ended up on his album. Manson was reportedly obsessed with the Beatles, particularly with their self-titled 1968 album, also known as the White Album. The album contained the song Helter Skelter, which Manson interpreted to prophesy an impending apocalyptic race war. Manson believed that there was simply no way that African Americans and Caucasian people could coexist. He believed that eventually a race war was inevitable, and it would pit black people against white people. After being released from a short prison stint in 1967, Manson went to San Francisco, where he started attracting a group of followers who later became known as the Manson Family. The core of the group was Charles Tex Watson, Bobby Busalil, Mary Brunner, Susan Atkins, Linda Kasabian, Patricia Krenwinkle, and Leslie Van Houten. They would participate in orgies, take hallucinogenic drugs, and listen to Manson's sermons. In 1969, they resettled at the Spahn Ranch, a rundown set of old buildings which looked like a Western movie set on the outskirts of Los Angeles. They became a doomsday cult, with Manson frequently referencing his upcoming race war and the transformation of America. On August 8, 1969, Manson called the family together and told them that it was now time for Helter Skelter. He told Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkle, and Linda Kasabian to get a change of clothes and a knife. He also told Tex Watson to drive them. Manson told the three women to leave a sign behind, quote, something witchy, end quote. Notably, there's no indication that Manson told any family member to commit any specific act of violence. Manson himself stayed behind at the Spahn Ranch. Shortly after midnight, now in the morning of August 9th, 1969, Watson, Atkins, Krenwinkle, and Kasabian pulled up to the residence of actress Sharon Tate, wife of famed director Roman Polanski, who was in London working on a movie called The Day of the Dolphin at the time. Keeping Tate company while Polanski was gone was coffee heiress Abigail Folger, her boyfriend Wojtek Frykowski, and celebrity hairstylist Jay Sebring. Watson cut the phone lines to the house, and the four Manson family members started up the driveway. Unfortunately, an 18-year-old named Stephen Parent had just pulled into the driveway at that time. Most accounts believe Parent was simply lost and turning around, but no one will ever be able to say for sure because Watson stopped his car, stuck his hand through the window, and shot Parent four times in the head without saying a word. While Kasabian stayed with the family car, the other three entered Tate's house. Watson described what happened next as the four victims running around the place like chickens with their heads cut off. All told, 102 stab wounds were spread across the four inhabitants of the house. Atkins would later confess that she went to a pool of Sharon Tate's blood and, after tasting it, used it to write the word pig on the porch wall. When a maid arrived at the house the next morning, she found the bodies of Folger and Frykowski mutilated on the lawn. Tate was in the living room on the floor, and Sebring had a rope tied around his neck and a towel on his face. In an interview later in life, Manson said that he was actually displeased with how the Tate killings were carried out. He described them as too messy. Because of that, Manson decided to accompany the family on the next Helter Skelter mission, which he scheduled for the following night. Manson brought the four from the previous night and added Clem Tufts and Leslie Van Houten. After driving aimlessly around Los Angeles for some time, Manson directed Kasabian to take the car to the home of Lino and Rosemary LaBianca. As they arrived, Manson told Watson, Krenwinkle, and Van Houten to go into the home and the rest to remain in the car. Lino LaBianca was found with a knife stuck in his throat, 12 knife stab wounds, and 7 fork stab wounds. The word war had been carved into his stomach. Rosemary LaBianca had stab wounds to her chest and neck. On the living room wall, death to pigs and rise had been written in blood. In the kitchen, on the refrigerator, one person wrote, Helter Skelter. Once news of the killings found their way to the press, the sensational nature made for lead stories and headlines. Law enforcement was stunned at first. No motives were apparent. The killings were frenzied and brutal. Interviews of friends and family members of the victims revealed no suspects. The messages scribbled in blood did not fit any previous patterns. In short, the police started off on their investigation with almost nothing to go on. But as fortune would have it, the police caught a break. In October 1969, 24 members of the Manson family were arrested on completely unrelated charges of arson and grand theft. Among those picked up were Charles Manson himself and Susan Atkins. While Atkins was in custody, she befriended another inmate named Virginia Graham. She told Graham how she killed Sharon Tate, about tasting the blood, about how everyone in the house had cried for help and mercy. She also told Graham that when she got out, she and the other family members were going to kill Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton, Tom Jones, Steve McQueen, Frank Sinatra, and many other celebrities to start a race war. Virginia Graham had no idea what to do with this information, but she phoned a friend, Ronnie Howard, and relayed to him what Atkins had said. Howard brought it to the LAPD. Also in October, detectives investigating the LaBianca murders started speaking to members of a motorcycle biker group called Straight Satan. Anonymous tips had come to the LAPD that some members of the group may know who were responsible for murders which bore a striking resemblance to the LaBianca murders. Detectives made their way to Straight Satan member Al Springer, who said that while he had been at the Spahn Ranch in August, Manson had bragged about knocking off 5 people and writing something about pigs on a refrigerator in blood. Springer's story was corroborated by Danny DiCarlo, who heard another Manson family member brag that they had got 5 piggies. When the LAPD expressed skepticism on why Manson and his family members would be bragging about murders to people they barely knew, Springer and DiCarlo both indicated independently that Manson was trying to recruit the whole biker gang into the family. That got the LAPD's attention. The LA County District Attorney selected Vincent Bugliosi to handle the Manson family prosecution. Bugliosi had won 103 of his 104 felony trials. He heard Ronnie Howard's recount of Susan Atkins' story. He directed law enforcement to interview all the other members of the Manson family which were in custody on the arson and grand larceny case. This resulted in narrowing down the suspects to the people actually involved in the Tate and LaBianca murders. Atkins was still in custody on the other charges, but Kasabian, Krenwinkle, Van Houten, and Watson were at large. Van Houten was found in California. Tex Watson was arrested by a sheriff in Texas. Krenwinkle was found in Mobile, Alabama. And Linda Kasabian surrendered to police in Concord, New Hampshire. Somehow, Bugliosi managed to convince Susan Atkins' attorney that she should testify in the grand jury against the remaining members of the family in return for him not seeking the death penalty. This was especially impressive given the adoration that the family members heaped on Manson and how blindly they followed him. Dutifully, Atkins described the events at the Tate residence for the grand jury. Speaking almost robotically, she showed no emotion, no remorse. She said that she felt dead upon returning to the ranch afterwards. The grand jury indicted Manson, Watson, Krenwinkle, Atkins, Van Houten, and Kasabian. Clem Tufts was not charged. All the defendants went to trial together, with the exception of Tex Watson. Politics had gotten in the way of Watson's extradition. He was not back in California at the time the trial started. The judge on the case was the Honorable Charles Older, a retired Marine Corps pilot who fought in the Pacific in World War II, and then in the Korean War. He was appointed to the bench in 1967 by Ronald Reagan, who was then governor of California. As this trial took place in 1970, Older had been on the bench only 3 years before handling what would become easily the most notable case of his entire career. Jury selection was incredibly difficult. At the outset, jurors were told that they would be sequestered in a hotel during the entirety of the trial. Many people were excused because of the hardship that that would entail for them. After an entire month of jury selection, the trial jury of 7 men and 5 women was seated. One was a mortician, another a retired deputy sheriff, an elderly security guard was another. There was one male in his early 20s with long hair and a mustache. The remainder were older and gave the appearance of a more law and order bent. I can't say what the composition was of the panels that the attorneys in the Manson case went through in Los Angeles County between mid-June and mid-July 1970, but the final group certainly seemed to favor Bugliosi, just based on ages and vocations. Manson's attorney was a man named Irving Kanarek. He was loathed by judges and prosecutors. He was called, quote, "the most obstructionist man I have ever met," end quote, by a judge he appeared in front of. Each attorney has their own style in the courtroom that's forged over experience, figuring out what works for them, what doesn't. Some attorneys have a nice, easygoing manner that tends to attract and disarm jurors. Others take a more bullish approach and try to bulldoze witnesses, trying to impress the jury. Kanarek's unique style was to confuse juries, to obfuscate, try and knock opposing counsel off their stride with antics and turning trials into circuses. Bugliosi, for his part, objected to Kanarek substituting in as Manson's counsel, but Judge Older could find no legal reason to prevent it, which is he didn't like it either. Opening statements in the trial began on July 24th, 1970. Manson entered the courtroom that day with an X carved into his forehead. He issued a statement that he had X'd himself from the world. The following day, his 3 women co-defendants all showed up to court, having carved an X into their forehead. In Bugliosi's opening statement, he shocked the press, which had crowded into the courtroom, by stating that Linda Kasabian would be a principal prosecution witness. Bugliosi had offered her immunity in exchange for testimony against Manson. Presumably, this was due to Atkins refusing to testify at the actual trial itself. Just to give an example of Irving Kanarek's style, as soon as Bugliosi called Linda Kasabian to the stand, Kanarek shot to his feet and objected on the grounds that she was clearly insane and not competent to testify. That was immediately overruled as baseless. Later, Kasabian admitted that she had taken LSD approximately 50 times on her direct testimony. On cross-examination, Kanarek asked her what she had experienced on LSD trip number 23, as if her failure to remember the specifics of one hallucinogenic incident cast doubts on her ability to remember the most significant nights of her entire life. Kanarek was found in contempt of court 4 times during the Manson trial, which is nearly impossible for a trial attorney to do. Manson himself was not terribly impressed with Kanarek and repeatedly threatened to have him killed. Outside the presence of the jury, but while the trial was still going on, Judge Older told Kanarek that he was, quote, "totally without scruples, ethics, or professional responsibility," end quote. Linda Kasabian testified for 18 full days. She had left the Spahn Ranch shortly after the murders, testified that she was riddled with guilt and felt the need to come clean. She was a powerful and believable witness. She was prepared well by Bugliosi and unshakable over the many, many days of cross-examination. But Kasabian's testimony really accentuated what would be the major issue for the prosecution in the case. Charles Manson never told anyone to kill Sharon Tate or her houseguests. He didn't give them any explicit instructions at all when he sent them out. He didn't tell them where to go. He didn't tell them what to do. So could he be personally held legally responsible for these murders? This is a good opportunity to discuss the law of conspiracy and joint responsibility. Let's start with conspiracy. There's a big difference between being charged with a substantive crime and being charged with conspiracy to commit that crime. It isn't necessary to prove that a person charged with conspiracy actually committed the substantive crime in order to convict them. That's because the crime of conspiracy has completely different elements than a substantive crime. As an example, California Penal Code 187 is the specific statute which covers murder. Murder is described in California as the unlawful killing of a human being with malice aforethought. Broken down, this statute requires that a defendant cause the death of another person and requires an intentional mental state, meaning that the death was not caused by accident or reckless behavior. Conspiracy, on the other hand, is a crime of agreement to do something illegal. Conspiracy requires two things. The first is an agreement between two or more people to commit a criminal act. You cannot conspire by yourself. The agreement does not need to be written down and signed and dated, but a prosecutor needs to be able to show that there was an understanding between at least two people that some sort of criminal act was going to be committed. The second element of conspiracy is far more nuanced. It requires that the defendant take some sort of overt act to achieve the goals of the conspiracy. That overt act does not need to be the substantive crime itself. It can be anything which is calculated in order to further the conspiracy's goal. But it does have to relate to the goals of the conspiracy. It can't be just any crime. Let's take an example. If Evan and Yossi conspire to rob a bank, I love bank robbery examples. If you haven't figured that out, they're pretty universally applicable. Okay, so Evan and Yossi meet in Yossi's basement. They decide to rob a bank. They decide which bank. They pick the date. They plan who's going to do what. They have clearly entered into an agreement to rob the bank. They have not yet committed the crime of conspiracy because no overt act has been taken by either of them. The agreement itself cannot constitute the overt act. The day before the planned robbery, let's say that Evan goes out and buys a small amount of cocaine, while Yossi goes to Home Depot, buys duct tape, zip ties, canvas duffel bags, and painter's masks. Evan has committed a substantive crime. He bought drugs. There's no question that that's illegal. But buying cocaine is not in furtherance of the plan to rob a bank. So he hasn't actually committed the crime of conspiracy. On the other hand, Yossi's trip to Home Depot is certainly not criminal in and of itself. He simply purchased certain items which Home Depot lawfully sells. But those purchases are easily argued to be in preparation to rob a bank. So Yossi has committed conspiracy to rob the bank. Even though the act of conspiracy requires an agreement of two or more people, Yossi can be charged with conspiracy alone without Evan, because he alone has met all the elements. Manson was charged both with conspiracy and the substantive murders themselves. Now, let's talk about vicarious or joint liability for a moment. Once a conspiracy is established, each member of the conspiracy can be charged for each substantive crime committed by members of the conspiracy under the theory that every member of the conspiracy is responsible for all the acts which further the conspiracy's goal. In that regard, let's go back to our example of Evan and Yossi. But now, let's add Alexandra, because it's 2021 and women can be criminals too. Evan goes out and buys cocaine. Yossi goes to Home Depot and buys duct tape, zip ties, masks, bags, etc. Now let's say Alexandra was at the meeting. She entered into the agreement. And the day before the bank robbery, while Yossi is at Home Depot, Alexandra buys three unregistered handguns from the trunk of a guy's car in a back alley. Since the three have discussed robbing a bank, buying guns is an overt act in furtherance of that conspiracy. But now Alexandra has, unlike Yossi, committed a substantive crime of buying guns, as well as entering into the conspiracy. because she and Yussi are both engaged in conspiracy, Yussi can now be charged with the illegal gun purchase as well, under the theory of vicarious liability. Now that we understand that, let's get back to the Manson trial. Here is what Bugliosi argued to tie Manson into the conspiracy and to claim actual responsibility for the physical murders themselves. Bugliosi told the jury that Manson was striking out against the establishment who had rejected him, that he wanted to end the establishment once and for all through the helter-skelter race war, and that he actually believed he could jumpstart the process with these killings. He described the family as slavishly obedient to Manson's will. And though Manson had not personally been there, his obsessive delusions of helter-skelter and his pronouncement on the day of the Tate murders that the time for helter-skelter had come was an indirect, although clear, order to murder. The influence which was exerted over the family, their willingness to do literally anything Manson ordered, and utter inability to act outside of his will, was proof that Manson had, despite not uttering the specific words to kill Sharon Tate and company, made his will on the subject quite clear. The order to start Helter Skelter, according to Bugliosi, was the overt act to put him into the realm of conspiracy. But beyond that, Bugliosi claimed, even though Manson stayed at the Spahn Ranch for the Tate murders and did not go into the house during the LaBianca murders, he was guilty of the actual murders by issuing the command that they be carried out. The jury was allowed to infer that although there was no direct evidence of Manson directing the Tate murders at all, that his will was made clear through his obsessive preaching about the impending race war and how to bring it about. This is how Bugliosi described it. Quote, "If A and B conspired to murder X, and pursuant to that agreement, B murders X, A, even though he was not the actual killer, is equally guilty of that murder. I don't care where he was. He could have been playing tennis, badminton, anywhere. He was a member of that conspiracy. He was guilty of that murder. That is the law of conspiracy, and there are just no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Even Charles Manson was merely a member, just a member of this conspiracy to commit these murders and never killed anyone. He would still be guilty of all seven murders. But here, he is not only a member, he is a leader, the leading force behind all of these conspiracies." End quote. I personally think my example was better, but Bugliosi was quite effective. Kanarek's trial strategy was to claim that Manson had simply done nothing wrong, that he lived a lifestyle that the establishment despised, so they wanted to kill him via the death penalty. Kanarek claimed that the prosecution was a personal attack on a man without a shred of evidence that he ever ordered anybody to commit murder. Both Kanarek and Bugliosi's summations were full of personal attacks aimed at the other. When Kanarek did talk about Manson, he asserted over and over that Manson had done nothing wrong, but that the establishment was trying to convict him of murders for which he had no involvement. It was a fairly simple and clean argument, but the trial evidence completely contradicted it. The prosecution case lasted a full 22 weeks. When Bugliosi rested, Kanarek shocked everyone by claiming that the defense had no witnesses and would rest as well. The three women being tried with Manson immediately demanded to testify and claimed that Manson had nothing to do with the murders. At that point, Manson too decided that he wished to testify. Judge Older handled the situation by sending the jury out, letting Manson take the stand, and previewing his testimony. This brought about a very interesting legal issue. A criminal defendant has a fundamental constitutional right to either testify or remain silent during a trial. It is 100% the client's decision. The rest of trial strategy is directed by the attorney, but a lawyer cannot tell a client that he or she cannot testify. So when Manson stated that he wanted to take the stand, Kanarek was legally bound to permit him to do so. But Kanarek was so against the idea that he refused to question Manson. So Manson just made a statement. Technically, this is legally permissible. There is no rule that a lawyer is required to ask questions of any witness, even their own client, especially if the lawyer believes that his client will lie or that any answers the client gives will damage the attorney's case. Being outside the presence of the jury, the damage here was mitigated as only the judge would hear what Manson wanted to say. Manson was then cross-examined by Bugliosi. His testimony largely consisted of railing against the establishment and claiming that society itself was evil, not him. He did not directly deny the charges against him, he just attacked the prosecution and claimed to be a victim of this whole situation. When he finished speaking, the judge asked him if he wanted to testify in front of the jury. At that point, Manson declined, indicating he had said what he felt he needed to say. Manson then instructed Krenwinkel, Atkins, and Van Houten that they did not need to testify, and they remained silent. On January 25, 1971, the jury found Manson guilty of all 7 murders, plus the conspiracy charge. While the trial was still ongoing, President Richard Nixon weighed in, calling Manson guilty, directly or indirectly, of 7 murders without reason. There was significant backlash in the media about the president commenting on an ongoing criminal trial. It was declared to be horribly inappropriate for a sitting president to weigh in his thoughts and feelings on the guilt or innocence of an ongoing trial. That idea seems to have left American society, as President Joe Biden voiced his own belief in the guilt of Derek Chauvin while the jury was deliberating without any real backlash whatsoever. In summation, Bugliosi had all the cards in this case. He had a star witness, granted immunity, who could walk through the exact actions everyone took. He had a defendant who was wholly unsympathetic and unrepentant. He had the media labeling the family a cult of violence and orgies, and he was facing off against a defense attorney who specialized in being off-putting. For his own part, Bugliosi made the trial more personal with Canarac than he should have. He had everything he needed to win without lobbing insults at his opposition's demeanor and personality. But that's what Canarac wanted. Some attorneys will simply try and drag you down to their level, where they can get the jury to focus on their disdain for each other rather than the evidence in the case. Canarac clearly knew that the evidence did not support him. He probably didn't do himself any favors by describing the victims as merely having passed away and avoiding the term murder or kill throughout the entire trial. You lose credibility with the jury when you pull stunts like that. I don't think anyone seriously disputes that the jury got this one right, and that Manson was indeed guilty of murder. But this case does allow us to look at the interesting rule of vicarious liability and conspiracy, and how a person does not need to be physically present to commit a crime. In fact, they don't even need to command that it happen, if a reasonable person would understand exactly what they meant by their seemingly vague instructions. Manson died of natural causes in prison in 2017, having initially been sentenced to the death penalty. But the year after he was sentenced, 1972, California outlawed capital punishment, and Manson sat in prison, being denied parole at every hearing ever since. He has never expressed any remorse for the murders whatsoever. Well, that's the show for this episode. Thank you, as always, to Dan Townsend, who continues to improve the production quality through exceptional audio engineering. And a special shout-out to my listeners in Ireland, where my ancestors hail from in part. Thankful to have your support on the Emerald Isle. If you want to get in touch with me, you can send me an email at insummationpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet me at insummationpod, or you can find me at my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. If you enjoyed this episode but haven't listened to any others, please check out the rest and subscribe on whatever platform you have so you'll get episodes automatically delivered. Until next time, I'm Paul Townsend. Thanks for stopping by, and I hope that you'll come back for more.